Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, Tom Lando, and as always, my co-host is...
McGill.
And we have, first off, a correction. Last session was not my session 31. I accidentally did session 31 twice. Last session was my session 32. This is not the first time this has happened, but I went through. Now we'll be all in order with saying this is my session 33, Operation Coffinborn.
I like to imagine that we have like a really diehard fan listening to us and going like, but wait a minute, he said last time it was 31. Damn it.
I mean, I like to have that consistency in case a fan is paying that close attention someday. And what else? I mean, tonight it's the Canadian Turkey Day.
Metric Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I guess you could call it that. I know you had a big old family dinner of sorts. I'm literally just sitting with a bowl of spicy shepherd's pie in my lap, having a late dinner that it's just me and my sister. We just cooked up a shepherd's pie, so. And then I put sriracha in it and mixed it all up. So that's our food situation. I mean, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. But yeah, McGill is well fed. I am all set up. As I was just telling McGill before we started, I don't know how much material I have, but I guess we'll make do.
I seem to recall the last time you said this, you actually wound up having a lot of stuff to cover.
I managed to do all right, yeah. So, but, you know, like to cover my bases. We'll see. But like I said, for me, session 33, Operation Coffinborn. Meanwhile, what do we got going on in your Verdant Apocalypse?
Chapter 3, I don't have titles for my chapters, but where we last left off, our players had found themselves kind of cornered in a greenhouse that has carnivorous plants inside, and they'd been chased in there by a couple of putrid slods, big sort of red, gross frog creatures.
Yeah. Do we want to pick up from there then?
Sure, I guess I'll go first. The players had taken refuge.
Caught between a piranha plant and a sloppy toad monster.
It's a good place to leave a session off. So the players were kind of getting their bearings after this. They had come in through a trap door in the floor of the greenhouse and then barred it shut, and they could hear the slod monsters banging on the hatch while they looked around in the greenhouse. And as they were looking around, that's when they got accosted by some carnivorous plants, and they fought them off. And so this session picked up right after that little encounter, and it's a fairly sizable greenhouse because it's on a university campus. So there's a lot of room inside. You know, at one point it was home to student botany projects or biology projects. And so the players, after they've calmed down a bit from the combat, they start looking around, and Critter immediately notices that there are a lot of drug production plants being grown here. There are poppies and there's cannabis being grown.
Sweet. The things and, you need.
Exactly. And so he starts pocketing some buds of weed because he's that kind of sleazy character. But as the players are looking around, Sadie, who I had fan cast as being the NPC played by Pam Grier, she pushes back a big hedge of greenery, and there's another carnivorous plant there, and it lashes out and it slashes her with one of its plant, its vegetal tendrils, And she falls over and she starts convulsing and having a reaction to it. And the players, you know, sort of fly into a panic.
Pam Grier.
Yeah. The players kind of fly into a panic. A couple of them went and took out that carnivorous plant, and the others like gathered around her to try to attend to her. Doc, the EMT, of course, starts trying to stabilize her, but she's having like a really violent reaction. And as he's rolling his heal checks on her, I had the other players roll what are now perception checks, but spot and listen checks for this system. And Rosa, Caitlin's character, noticed that the banging on the hatch had stopped. And so as the other players are attending to Sadie, Rosa walks over to the hatch and she leans down. She's about to put her ear to it when she hears a very distinct, like, knock, knock, knock on the other side. And Rosa was played as sort of like a brash, you know, know-it-all kid. And so she decides she's just going to see who it is. She opens the hatch, and there on the ladder, like hanging off the ladder down into the sewer system underneath, are three university, like early 20s, maybe the youngest one is 19, three guys. And there's no way to say this other than to say they're nerds. They're three like sweaty, kind of chubby nerds, scraggly hair and like patchy facial hair. And they're all wearing blankets like capes. And so they immediately climb up and they go, and I did the full nerd voice and everything. Oh, thank you for letting us in. And as soon as these three new NPCs pop in, the other, you know, characters in the party turn to look and go like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And Critter runs over and like slams one of them up against the wall and goes like, who are you guys? You know, there's a bit of a confrontation there, but they quickly calm down when they realize these nerds aren't a threat. The nerds introduce themselves as, I have it here, Thomas, David, and Gavin. And just in talking to them, it becomes clear that they have been hiding out in the sewer systems underneath the campus. And they're basically LARPers. This was very much inspired by like Mazes and Monsters, the idea of these university kids doing live action role playing in the tunnels underneath the university. And so the party, like,
man, how come we never did that? We had tunnels under our university.
I know, right? I have this feeling that somewhere under Carleton University, at the time when we were there, there were probably people LARPing down there. I wouldn't be surprised. People did all sorts of things down there. So, Thomas, David, and Gavin
drove motorcycles.
Yeah, they drove dirt bikes through the halls. That was really something. Wonder if they ever caught that guy. Anyway.
It was something like they tracked it through his Facebook. They found out he was like in the military or something.
Oh my God.
Or like through his YouTube account. But we should actually really, if that video was still up on YouTube, we should really link it on our supplementary materials.
Yeah, we'll put that on our WordPress because that was pretty legendary when it was going around.
It's such a cool video.
It's what everybody who went to Carleton, that's what they wanted to do, man. You wanted to tear down those tunnels on some kind of vehicle, be it a motorcycle or even just a bicycle.
Or one of those damn maintenance carts that was.
Yeah,
always...
one of those tunnel carts. Somebody, we're going off on a big tangent here, but somebody even made like a game called Grand Theft Tunnel Cart, where the map was the Carleton tunnels and you could steal the tunnel carts and drive them around. So the trio of nerds introduce themselves. It becomes clear very quickly that they aren't a threat, and they say that they scared off the slads with a flare gun that they have, and that the slads generally don't like light. So that's like a clue. They don't call them slads, they just called them monsters. But that's like sort of a clue. They only come out at night, they stay in the dark, and that's a way that the players might be able to fend them off next time. Doc assesses that Sadie has been stabilized, but in order for her to heal, she's going to need actual medicine. And so that kind of sets the nerds quaking in their shoes. And they say, like, you know, well, the only place on campus that has any medicine left is the medical center, which I described last time as being sort of, this abandoned medical center that had the words Rat Haven scrawled on the wall out front with like a crude drawing of a rat king. And so they're like, if you want to get your medicine, you got to go into the Rat Haven. And so the players decide, like, okay, I guess this is what we have to do. Between all of them, they don't have much in the way of weaponry. And so the party decided at this point, Beulah in particular, had like some combat skills and stuff and like a high survival check, I guess because she had been built sort of as a security guard. And so she leads the players in improvising a bunch of like machetes, you know, find like a long flat piece of metal and then sharpen it and like wrap some cloth around one end for a handle. And so the party now equips themselves with some makeshift blades and they decide, all right, we're going to venture into the,
I just want to establish that at this point, Kenny has been scouring opium from the poppy seeds like since they got here, basically.
Yes, of course. Kenny's gonna like OD when nobody's looking.
It's definitely gonna be too high for this rat haven.
So yeah, the players improvise weapons, and even though the nerds are scared, I mean, they're LARPers, they fancy themselves, you know, heroes. So okay, we'll lend our sword to your quest kind of thing. And they have a few other items. Like I said, they have a flare gun and they have spears that they've made and shields made out of like road signs. And so the players decide like, okay, we're going to go into the medical complex. And it's at this point as well that Thomas, David, and Gavin mention to the players too, like, but you got to watch out for the Omegas, this gang that is occupying the campus that nobody's encountered yet. So like, keep an eye out. They never go into the Rat Haven, but guaranteed that's their drug stash.
I bet I know where they're
pilfering.
I know. I bet I know where the Omegas post up.
Oh, where?
So the Rat Haven is the medical center.
Yeah.
So they are posted up at Mr. Tachihori's down on Sullivan Street across from the medical center.
Well, not quite, but I'm not going to spoil it. I will, though, give sort of a preview of coming events and say that chapter 4, you find out exactly where they've made their base of operations on the campus. So there you go. You'll find out next time. And so the players steel themselves and venture into the Rat Haven. They also make, of course, makeshift torches. They make torches out of like sticks and things so that they have some light, and then venture into the medical complex. And I ran this part just like a straight up dungeon crawl. And once again, because I was basing this on an actual place, I could just go to the campus website and download a floor plan of the medical center. And then I went on Google and I found, you know, a few dozen photos of urban exploration of like abandoned hospitals or asylums, things like that, to set the mood as the players ventured from room to room. And
Kenny's just like high out of his mind singing Moving Out by Billy Joel incessantly since they found out it was the medical center.
Shut up.
He only remembers the one verse. He just keeps doing the Mr. Tachihori is down on Sullivan Street across from the medical center.
Oh my God.
Can't wait for Kenny to die this episode.
Yeah, looking forward to that. So, as I said, I was just running this as a dungeon crawl. I had even sort of, to a degree, randomized where they'll find the medicine that they're looking for as well. I made a point of putting it like nowhere near the entrance, but I had like a cluster of rooms near the center of the building that I went, it's in one of these rooms. And so when they get to those rooms, I'm just going to have them roll their search checks to search through the debris. And if somebody succeeds, bam, they're going to find it there. So give them a few challenge rooms, you know, give them a few rooms that are going to put up a challenge and maybe they'll find some stuff. But any search checks before that cluster of rooms in the middle, they weren't going to find what they were looking for, but they might find something useful, especially if they roll high. And then for monsters in this, well, it's the Rat Haven. So I decided that I wanted the monsters to be every form of D&D rat that I could put together. And I'm not talking about like, you know, rat men or anything like that. I just mean like there's the rat.
I was about to say, because that would start to, there would start to be some like moral complications if, you know, that's Kenny would try to make friends with a rat man.
No, no. Just like every variant of rat. So there's rat, there's swarm of rats that you can use as a monster, and then there are giant rats and also dire rats. And one thing that I kept the stats.
Shame you didn't know Warhammer Fantasy too well back then, because you could have included rat ogres.
Rat ogres. Oh yeah, you know, tell me, Tom, do you have some go-to? You're like, well, you know, rat ogre skeletons, if you want a nice second level skeleton for your players to fight, the rat ogre skeleton.
I think generally when I do rat stuff, it's either, like you say, swarm of rat, giant rat, or I, you know, sometimes I'll mess with a were rat, you know, but
yep. So one change that I did make across the board, though, is that I gave all of these different kinds of rats the dire rat trait of disease. So if you get bitten, you have to make a fortitude save. And if you fail, then it does dex and con damage after 1d3 days. The filth fever, as it is known. And so this, again, just like straightforward dungeon crawl, players going room to room, searching for things. They found a bunch of gear, but really the only thing of actual note and use was a couple of them actually found handguns. And one of them was loaded. So now they have some ranged weaponry. They actually have a couple of guns in the party. And I've stated before that part of my objective with this campaign in general was to make like make the basics challenging, sort of revel in the difficulty of just doing things like searching a building, because this is this crumbling world. And another factor, of course, is the rats will give you disease if they bite you, so don't get touched by them. Try to avoid all that. A few of the players did get bitten, but it's a fairly low fortitude save, so they managed not to get infected. But it was, you know, there were definitely moments where they'd roll on that scavenging system from D20 Apocalypse. They'd, you know, their foot would punch through the floor, or a ceiling panel would fall open and like rats would pour out of it on top of them, and they'd have to get them off before being bitten and fight them away. It's also really interesting watching your players deal with like diminutive or small or even diminutive challenges, because you're used to fighting something like humanoid, right? You're used to fighting like a gang of orcs or goblins where,
or a monster. Like it is a very interesting kind of subtype of enemy, like swarms in particular.
Yeah, exactly. Because how do you deal with it? There's so many of them. More often than not.
Just while we're on the topic, I wonder, are you familiar with the way swarms tend to work in 5th edition?
No, actually.
So generally the way it works is that they're generally immune to a lot of, you know, conditions, things like, you know, they can't be knocked over, obviously, because it's a swarm. But the general way it works is that you have two damage stats, and one of them is for when it is at full strength, and then when you get them below half health, they start doing less because it's like a weaker swarm now.
That makes a lot of sense, yeah. And I imagine that their damage is probably also, it probably scales according to whether or not they're at full strength, right?
Yeah, basically the way it works is that, you know, if a swarm of rats doesn't attack for like 4d6 regularly, then if you've wiped out more than half of its health, then you've wiped out enough rats that they start doing like 2d6 instead.
Makes perfect sense. I think that's an elegant way of handling it. But yeah, like you said, like players are used to fighting monsters, so sending them up against like 100 tiny targets, it always sort of throws them for a loop. I find that it gets a similar reaction if I'm putting them up against like an ooze. And players never know how to handle an ooze. It'll stick to them, and then they can't get it off, and they don't know what to do. So there were a lot of challenges where they are fighting a swarm of rats and they don't really know how to contend with this type of enemy. And then they're also doing it in a really unsafe, unstable environment. And there's the potential for like a wall to fall on top of them or them to fall through the floor down to the basement. And what ended up happening at one point is a whole bunch of debris fell down and it divided the party into two groups. And they could still like talk to each other through the pile of debris, but clearing it was obviously pretty impossible. So they decide they're going to split into these two groups and cover more ground. And the two groups were the three nerds and Beulah and Rosa, and then Doc and Critter and Warren, who was one of the other NPCs. And I should say that Meredith and Sadie and the other NPCs stayed.
Right, I was about to ask about Sadie.
Yeah, stayed back in the greenhouse. And yeah, the Gina Carano character stayed with her to guard her. And so I divided the party up. They continue searching. And the nerds and Beulah and Rosa reach the area that I designated as having.
Who's the one with the spandex outfit?
Meredith.
Okay.
The nerds and Gina and Beulah and Rosa arrive at the area I had designated as having the medicine in it. And so they pilfered the place until they found the medicine. Meanwhile, Doc and Critter and Warren kept searching and like exploring down these twisting hallways and everything. It's also, you know, quite dark. At one point they have to like wade through water that's like knee deep, and you can feel like rats swimming around their legs. And they wind up going sort of deeper into the building than they needed to get the medicine. And they push open a door, and inside, like, this is the rat's nest. And sure enough, in the middle of it is this giant, like, swarming, squirming rat king. All these rats with their tails entangled that I had operate sort of as a swarm of rats, but treating it almost like a single creature because they're all attached. They can't disperse. And Critter immediately grabs one of the guns and just starts shooting at the Rat King and making a whole bunch of noise. The other, you know, half of the party can hear this and start running towards their location. And I had a little encounter where they try to take out the Rat King, but there are just too many rats. And so they turn to beat a retreat. And as they're about to, like, as they're running down a hallway that is on the outer wall of the building, part of that wall gets pulled back outwards, and there are a bunch of Omegas there, and they've got a Jeep, and they've pulled a chunk of the wall out. And so they're standing there, and they've got like weapons trained on these guys, got them at gunpoint. And there's like a tense moment where the Omegas are like, well, 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 you know, what have we got here? Trespassing on Omega territory. Well, you know, if you trespass, you got to pay the price. So they grab Warren and Doc and Critter and throw them onto the back of the Jeep, and they take off across the campus. And through like a dirty window, Beulah and Rosa and the nerds can see this and watch them go. And they're like, oh my God, like, what are we going to do? And so to wrap up this part of this session, basically, I left Critter and Doc just in the dark as to what their fates were. And then I role played Beulah, Rosa and the nerds going back and giving the medicine to Sadie and then trying to decide what to do next. And that's where I drew it to a close. The Omegas have them. Now things are going to get really interesting.
Now, but the nerds had a flare gun, right?
Yeah.
Do they still have a flare gun?
They do.
I would have used that flare gun to shoot that rat's nest.
Oh, but they weren't at the rat's nest. They got separated, and they were in the cluster of rooms looking for medicine. It was
they should have gone.
Doc, Critter, and Warren found the Warren of rats.
They should have gone and burned that rat's nest is what should have happened.
Alas, they did not get to it, and then suddenly they were presented with a more pressing matter, which is rescuing their newfound friends.
Do they ever come back to the Rat Haven?
You know, I don't think they do, but they might. I'm trying to remember. I've only read like two more chapters ahead in my notes. I'll have to consult.
So, if they do come back, we may have to retcon this, but I'm going to say that Kenny is going to take that flare gun and do a heroic self-sacrificing thing where he runs into the rat's nest and shoots the flare gun.
Yeah, the nerds and Rosa and Beulah get back to the greenhouse. They give Sadie her medicine. She comes to and she goes, hey, where is Kenny? And then we cut to Kenny like setting himself on fire.
He's in a flaming nest of rats and he's like, and I'm moving out. Da 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 da. And then
picks up a flaming rat, lights a doobie off it. Nice.
Nice.
They killed Kenny. Those bastards.
I mean, yeah, every time. So, I guess that's
chapter three. It was like mostly a dungeon crawl. Dungeon crawls are always sort of, you know, they're a bit lackluster to describe, but they're always pretty fun to run.
It is interesting to me, though, that you had that system with the, like, general area where they were going to find the medicine rather than having, like, a map where you had pinpointed the actual place that it was. Like that is a difference between this dungeon crawl, say, and the dungeon crawls I had been doing in the previous act of my game.
And, you know, I think the reason for it is at the time I was playing a lot of the board game Last Night on Earth. You ever played that board game?
Nope.
It's a really great board game. It's modular in a way that allows you to sort of change the map based on different scenarios that you can play. And, it ideally you play with six people, four people play heroes, and then the other two players play the zombie horde. And you set up the board each time, almost like HeroQuest, so that you're playing a scenario where it's like, okay, the heroes have to defend the manor house from the zombies, and if more than five zombies get into the house at one time, the zombies win. Or the players need to get across the map to the forklift and then drive it back to the starting point and survive. But if they don't do it before the sun goes down, then the zombies win, that kind of thing. And part of the mechanics of that board game are searching mechanics, where you can enter a building and then you can search. And in scenarios where you're looking for a particular object, like you need a quest item, the way they do it is you mix those quest items into the random deck of things that you can find when you search. And so you'll search, and then you'll draw a card from the deck, and maybe it'll be like a shotgun or dynamite or a gas can, or if you're lucky, you'll draw the quest item. And so because I was playing a lot of that game around the time that I was running this adventure, I think that's why I decided to set it up this way, where it's like, you don't know necessarily which room it's going to be in, but you go and you search, and then it's like, You know, there's a bit of randomness to whether or not you find it in that particular room. Also because it's like medicine, so they're in a medical complex. Theoretically, there'd be medicine everywhere, right? But, so I don't know. I guess that's why I approached right. that way.
So, well, you can always narrow it down by being like, you need this specific medicine. But yeah, it's funny. You mentioned HeroQuest, and that is something that comes up in my old White Dwarfs enough that I might be able to do a tavern talk on that sometime.
Oh, man, it's been a very long time since I played HeroQuest.
Dwarf is full of ads for HeroQuest and Talisman and old things like that.
Talisman's pretty fun. I bought a HeroQuest like board game box at a yard sale, and then half the pieces were missing. It was really disappointing.
I mean, like, I would almost expect that from a used game of HeroQuest, but it's funny. I think of those old games that you see advertised in, like, old White Dwarfs and stuff. There's, like, HeroQuest, Talisman, the Rogue Trooper one. But the one I actually considered even bringing it to the tavern today, but it's not really a role-playing game, is Chainsaw Warrior. Are you familiar with Chainsaw Warrior?
Yeah, I've never even heard of that. That sounds pretty awesome, though.
Chainsaw Warrior. I'm pretty sure. I just want to make sure that I get this right. Because now it is like designed. Now there's an online version and like a mobile version and stuff.
This is on Steam. I should play this.
It's listed here. Yeah, it is. It's listed here as a single-player board game. But I am almost certain that the ads in White Dwarf are basically saying, call this hotline and you will play this game by phone with somebody. And basically, it's like, you know, it's a lot like Doom. It's like you are a chainsaw warrior. It's basically the apocalypse. A portal to hell has opened in a building. You got to fight your way through the building and try to close the portal to hell or whatever, you know. But, like, again, I feel like a lot of it was based on, like, play by phone and, like, you would pay to basically you pay for a hotline that would play this game with
great.
You basically, which is like a weird archaic thing. I mean, yeah, it's super funny. It's like those
video board games that come with a VHS tape.
Yeah. And the thing that, that fascinates me about it is that like the Chainsaw Warrior, had a miniature that was effectively like, it is the proto Space Marine, like the Space Marine that like Games Workshop went on to sell en masse as like their one of their most iconic figures, began as this badass space, you know, chainsaw warrior. It's great.
I gotta play that.
Yeah, I am very interested in like the newer interpretations that they have. But I am also fascinated in all the old, like, play-by-phone Chainsaw Warrior turn-by-turn. Because, like, it was a whole thing where it was on a time limit. So, like, you were trying to get through in the amount of time without dying. Anyway.
It really is like Nightmare or one of those video board games where there's, like, a ticking clock and then this sort of pre-recorded thing giving you instructions.
I don't know if you ever watch the Scottish program Limmy's Show, but
you're the second person to remind me of Limmy's Show this week. Another friend of mine, it was just like, been rewatching this classic and linked me to it on Facebook. I am familiar.
I'm a big, big fan of Limmy. He's actually a big time Twitch streamer now. But one of the sketches in Limmy's Show, one of the recurring sketches is he is doing like, basically it's a channel. The premise is that it's a channel you can tune to, and then call in. And then this guy played by Limmy named Falconhoof, who's like dressed up like a satyr, will like lead you on an adventure. And it's basically like a text-based adventure, but narrated to you by Limmy. And the bit is always, of course, that like there's an extremely difficult person on the other end of the line, who, of course, Limmy has to deal with because he's being paid for the time.
That is some like high concept comedy right there.
I mean, it's funny because I've seen interviews with him where he says that fans then said, like, you know, you could probably make a lot of money doing that. And he's like, yeah, I probably could, but it'd be awful. Anyway, if we're all done talking about your end of things.
Yeah, what's going on with MPOC's Finest?
MPOC's Finest are on to Operation Coffinborn, which picks up fairly directly from the last one, Operation Omega Rising, because as you'll remember in the past one, so just generally for this act, Goblin Princess Remy kidnapped. Goblin Town hit with some sort of biological weapon by the Nightside Eclipse. Nightside Eclipse is operating in Goblin Town, and only the MPOC can come to the rescue. So they're looking into it. They're trying to track down what the Nightside, like where the Nightside Eclipse is operating from. That led them to a smuggling operation. Led them to a ship where they were able to interrogate the captain, and also they found important clues among the like crates and whatnot in the supplies on the wharf when they were there. So that leads them to basically following the markings on these supplies. Like, okay, we got to figure out where these supplies are going, and then we'll be able to, you know, find out where the hideout is. And this leads to an interesting situation where this operation, at least the first half of it, literally took place on a railroad. And we all know that railroading is some sort of sin for DMs, isn't it?
Well, you're not supposed to do that unless you set your adventure on a literal railroad, which I've done.
And yeah, and so in this case, the characters, in order to follow these supplies, got onto a little flatbed car on one of these rail supplies because, as I mentioned, like Goblin Town is sort of technologically sophisticated relative to the rest of Drail. And so they had to follow this train, follow the railroad to the Nightside Eclipse hideout. Although I am getting a bit ahead of myself as well, because one thing that was also established with this operation is I had mentioned in the past various things that had been established because of carousing checks that I had done in downtime. And so one of these things was actually that Alistair Infernus, the warlock, had a dalliance with an elven or a half-elven cleric by the name of Ariel. And through that connection, we established that Ariel then took on work for the MPOC and became sort of like the go-to healer for the MPOC for a period of time. So basically, this was something that I was basically, I think at this point I had seen some of the stuff in Adventurers League, and one of the systems they have in there is just like a generalized system for like healing services. And I wanted to kind of represent that for the MPOC, and so I was able to implement that by introducing Ariel as this cleric who, for various like limited fees, you can go to for specific healing spells after an operation when you come back to base. So for example, if you've been hit with some sort of disease, you can go and you can pay a certain amount for access to greater restoration.
Remind me again, is there already a cleric in the party?
There's not a cleric, but there's a paladin. Magnus is a paladin of vengeance. And I mean, Valfarine Dragling guy is a bard. But yeah, there isn't a cleric, and so I did want to just sort of cover their bases in terms of, like, at least in their off time when they're not in a mission, they can generally get fixed whatever happens to them, you know? It can be particularly problematic if you have someone, like, get, like, permanently petrified or something. It's like the party's carrying around their statue, basically.
Hey, I know just the item to help with that. I'll talk about it in the tavern.
All right. I can think of a few myself. So, as for this railroad operation, this is why I don't really have a ton to talk about. There was basically, you know, they got onto the railroad, and then there was sort of, they got onto the train, actually, the sort of, like, cargo shipment, and I had it so that they initially sort of, like, fought their way up the train and were, like, examining the crates, and then as the train was moving, like, as they got close to the base, Nightside Eclipse were, like, spotting them and trying to, like, stop them and, like, putting debris in the way. So then they're trying to, like, stop the train and ambush them while they're on the train. And basically at this point, I think having done, like, I had just done the Smuggler's Wharf scenario where I did a lot of different types of NPC monsters, like, assassins, berserkers, cultists, cult fanatics, and all that. And I think just by looking at what I had in this operation, I think I had gone towards, like, simplifying that a bit by going towards just sticking with the ones that I felt were most effective so that I didn't have as many notes to keep track of. So generally, they were fighting cult fanatics and berserkers on the railway. And then eventually they reached sort of the end of the line, which was this rail yard where they found all the other shipments had been brought, like sort of a yard where they had all their crates from the smuggling operation, which, as I had mentioned last time, they had discovered that the items being smuggled were robot parts. So
that's right. Things are getting mechanical.
Yeah, so the train brought them to this sort of rail yard where they have all this stuff out, but then there is a tunnel that descends into the earth. And so they continue to fight the Nightside Eclipse in the rail yard. At one point, they run into a Minotaur skeleton in addition to the regular stuff. But this is all pretty easy stuff for them. I'm going to get to this in a bit, but then when they go into the tunnel, they're like, okay, this must be the entryway into, like, their hideout. They go into the tunnel, and initially they're fighting bad guys, and they fought, I'd mentioned that the sort of, like, leader of the vampires in Drail was Carbat, and they fought Carbat in the tunnel, but he managed to evade them. Being the sort of, like, upper echelon villain that he had prepared to do the sort of, like, we'll meet again, fools, and, like, you know, turn in a mist and get away before they can defeat him. Which is important because it saved him from having something very embarrassing happen to him. But then the real sort of final bosses of this point, of this operation, when they were descending into the tunnel, was finally they ran into a group of enemies that was led by two mummy lords, which are, like, challenge rating 15 enemies with, like, serious, like, legendary actions, magic, like, really debilitating spells. Though I will say they were not treated as being in a lair, so they were just mummy lords as is. There's a bunch of things I want to touch on here. First of all, I guess one thing is, like, why two mummy lords? Like, why two boss monsters, particularly ones I hadn't run before? And the reason was basically that it's key to know that at this point, the party was level 17. I can say that with certainty. Level 17 meant a lot of things. It means that Alistair Infernus got access to a ninth level spell, which I'll get to in a minute. But it also meant that just generally, the party was so effective and powerful that being not as familiar with 5e, and certainly not at the higher levels, I didn't have certain experiences that I have now that affect the way that I set up these kind of high-level encounters. So, for example, a mummy lord as written, like the average HP that is given is like 97, and I think I rounded it up to 100 just to make them like slightly tougher. But the fact is, what I discovered around this act with the party being level 17 is that, like, if you give a party of that level one, like, boss monster to target, they will take it out in, like, a turn. At least if you are treating it with, like, this level of HP, like, 100. Nowadays, I tend to have boss monsters, especially at high levels, like, with, like, 300 HP. I make them really beefy. But
I was going to ask, like, why two instead of just scaling up one?
And the thing is that, like, it's the issue of, like, particularly with Mieli being a very high-level rogue, and so she had this insane sneak attack damage that basically, you know, at this point now she's a gunslinger. So basically she can shoot the guy and immediately take down, like, almost half his HP, and then Magnus goes in and just, like, completely brutalizes them with, the crazy paladin divine strike or whatever it is that you use to, like, stack damage on people. And, you know, that's even if they don't roll crits, they can immediately delete one of those mummy lords. And I think, like, it's something that I definitely experienced was, like, if I put all that boss energy in one spot, they are just going to immediately get rid of it, and then it's just going to be another fight, which ends up being very anticlimactic, is what I'd found. And so this was the first time that I was starting to sort of work around this realization, and it's something that I continue to struggle with until the end of this campaign, honestly, is figuring out how to properly balance a combat encounter for these very high-level characters in a way that it would pan out satisfyingly. Not being way too hard, not being way too easy, and not being just like, oh, we beat the boss and now we're just fighting his minions, which is basically just the other fights that we've been having. If that makes sense.
It does.
The other thing to mention about this, so I mentioned that Alistair Infernus, as a warlock at level 17, now had access to a Mystic Arcanum, which is a single ninth level spell, and he chose True Polymorph, an old classic. Turn a thing into a different thing. There's limits to True Polymorph, but I mean, you can turn a person into an object of equivalent size. And Alistair, I'm pretty sure this was the first operation where he whipped out Alphrobaz, his own magic word that has gone down in infamy. Alphrobaz, True Polymorph, Alistair's frozen banana stand.
Wait. He polymorphs an enemy into a frozen banana stand?
About a goblin size one, because it needs to be medium size like the
good thing Lord. He polymorphs.
But yep, I am pretty sure that this operation was the first time that Drail became marked with one of Alistair's frozen banana stands. And I'll tell you, it was not the last time.
Oh my Drail, God.
Certain He's areas of Drail are just littered with frozen bananas. I mean, yeah, there are just little frozen banana stands dotting the landscape of Drail here and there, where you can tell that they had fights with somebody that he managed to get off a frozen banana stand, a true polymorph on.
So you
Alphrobaz.
You mentioned you've run more than one campaign in Drail, is that right?
Yes.
And in future campaigns, do you throw in little details where it's like you come to a crossroads and you notice overgrown on the edge of the forest the faded yellow sign of a banana stand?
I feel like I don't think it has ever actually happened. The thing is that I know where these banana stands are. So I have a pretty good idea of like where they would run into them. And they're like, it hasn't happened yet, basically. But I will say that, like, well, the campaigns afterwards, like, new players who join the game know about Alistair's frozen banana stand, and players that are rejoining the game from this campaign, of course, know about Alistair's frozen banana stand. So it is, it has gone down in infamy. But yeah, I don't want to say too much about like what the future holds for Alistair specifically. So, you know, in the interest of not getting ahead of ourselves, that's all I'll say for now. but it is worth mentioning because this is an issue in addition to that, you know, the rogue just deletes an enemy issue, because the warlock turns someone into a banana stand can be quite a deflation for any dramatic operation. And so therefore, when I say that, for example, Carbat, the like high level vampire warrior that I had them face in the tunnel, when I said he was like prepared to like sort of dip early so that he could do the like, ha ha ha, we'll meet again, whatever. Part of that was because I didn't want him getting turned into a frozen banana stand. I do believe that we had established though that like the rules are actually like you can't use true polymorph on a shape changer, which a vampire technically counts as. So I think that was also a factor in it, but I'm pretty sure one of these mummy lords got turned into a frozen banana stand.
So I have to say, this seems far more jokey than the contents of your campaigns tend to veer towards.
Yeah, but, you know, so first of all, it's the player's choice. He came to the table with that idea and he pitched it to me.
But would his character even know what a frozen banana stand was?
Well, that's the whole issue. I mean, sure. I mean, they'd run into fruit stands in Goblin Town already, candy shops. It's not like totally inconceivable. It is very specific and goofy, but you know, like I say, the end result is basically that, like, every here and there, there is just a small banana stand that marks where a warlock turned an enemy into a banana stand. And I mean,
did the banana stands appear with bananas in them?
I don't know. I don't know if we went into that much detail. I think it was just like, you know, there's a frozen banana stand there. I mean, there were obviously jokes about how there was always money in it, but I wasn't about to like fill it with gold. So, you know, it's, I think
how,
the thing is,
how would the bananas be frozen?
I mean, polymorph is just like you turn a thing into an object. It's like you just, I mean, they would probably thaw out.
At what point does a frozen banana stand, unattended, just become a banana stand?
I mean, that's the real thing. Is like, I don't think we need to get into that level of detail. It's like, the point is that he turned someone into an inanimate banana-shaped structure that, like, ostensibly is a banana stand. And I mean,
I was mainly just lining this up so I could make a Mitch Hedberg joke.
But, well, I will just say that, like, when you say, like, it seems too jokey, I think it is jokey, obviously, but the line for me with, like, too jokey is, like, I think this is kind of harmless in the grander scheme of things. It's like, you know, if people see weird themed fruit stands in the wilderness in Drail, whatever, you know, there's some fun lore behind that. It was created by a warlock polymorphing someone. And, you know, it doesn't really have to be more than that. Out of character, obviously, it's more than that, but...
Someone asked me if I wanted a frozen banana. I said, no, but I want a regular banana later, so, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. And I was thinking, I'm trying to think now, what's his thing about the poncho? It's just, if
gosh,
he tries to keep a blanket with him so that if he ever needs to, he has a poncho. Or he keeps a blanket and scissors so that at any given time he can have a poncho.
He's got that other banana joke where he goes, on a traffic light, green means go, but yellow means slow down. But on a banana, it's the opposite, where yellow means go ahead, and green means wait a minute, and red means where'd you get that banana?
And I'm also thinking of his other fruit-related joke, which is the whole thing about lemon and lime float. So when he's ever in a sinking ship scenario, he'll grab hold of a lime. So, yeah, I actually have some other, some other background stuff for my session. Now that we've covered sort of like the main points of the bulk of it, is another thing, something that they found while going through the crates at the rail yard was an alchemy jug, which I had mentioned previously. They ended up using this alchemy jug. Magnus took it and used it to create Magnus's Crimson Tower Brewery and Distillery, which he opened up at the old Crimson Tower. So that was the advent of that, was them getting the alchemy jug.
Cool.
From the shipment of various materials. Because, of course, if the Nightside Eclipse are up to some sort of biological weapon stuff, they're going to have alchemy materials. They're going to have, you know, robotics and stuff. And so an alchemy jug is a magic item that produces various different types of liquids and can be used to concoct things. And
was your party just like waiting for the opportunity to get into food service?
No, I wouldn't say so. Certainly not to the extent that I have had
got
other
like banana stands and a brewery.
Man, the thing is, like, now I'm running a game where a character is just like full on like a chef. So, yeah, I think I mentioned the Adamantine Chef competition. But anyway. Also, I have mentioned in the past about how Mealy comes from a plane where previously she and her fellow elves had been persecuted. Then when the party went to hell, she made a deal with Mephisto in order to ensure sort of elven supremacy in her home plane. And at this point, that had basically come to fruition, I established. Mealy had a little sort of... She just took a little trip to her home plane, basically, after the or around this operation. And around this time was when I established, like, okay, now, like, in your home world, there it's this kind of, like, I took a lot of inspiration from, like, the sort of industrial sets of Peaky Blinders, like, where you have the fire going off out of the furnaces everywhere and whatnot. And so you have this very sort of steampunk homeworld for Mealy, where everything is powered by Mephisto's hellfire that he's granted to the elves to give them, like, that edge over the other civilizations in their world. And so it's this world of, like, this hellfire steampunk world run by elves. where everybody else is kind of oppressed. And that's Mia Lee's homeworld now.
Neat.
So yeah, stuff happening in the background, stuff happening in the foreground, and next time they're heading right into that old factory. See what's what. That hideout underground. So, tavern time.
Is it that time already?
I think it's
we're gonna drink
time.
Some Crimson Tower beer at the tavern.
Oh yeah, Magnus's special brew.
Sounds good. Is it a red ale?
I think he had all sorts of different things you could get. Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to ask the player what the specifics were.
Well, while we drink these fine ales, do you want to go first or should I?
You can go first.
All right. So, Tom, this time I'm bringing with me a classic D&D item. A classic D&D starting item. Tell me, Tom, what is the most useful D&D starting item?
Okay, when you say starting item, does that mean it can't be a magic item?
That's right.
Ooh. Are we counting?
What's the cliche?
Like a 10-foot pole?
You know
I'm
it.
I'm just also saying, like, because I want to give my actual answer. Do you, like, are we counting kits?
Sure.
Thieves' tools. I think it's thieves' tools 100%.
Yeah. Yep. That's a pretty good one.
Healer's kit is another good one, especially in mine where I require it.
Rope. Rope is a classic.
Yeah, it's good to have rope.
But I want to talk to you about the 10-foot pole. And I am drawing from this article from nerdsonearth.com called I Wouldn't Touch This with a 10-Foot Pole. And they give just some details about the 10-foot pole. They talk about, like, actual real-life uses for it. But more to the point, the history of the 10-foot pole in D&D. And some of the stuff I didn't even know. The part about all the utilities, like all the different ways you can use a 10-foot pole, that stuff I knew, but I didn't realize how it came about being this sort of like running joke in Dungeons & Dragons.
I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot clown pole.
And it's because back in old school D&D, there wasn't a skill check to disarm traps. They just hadn't invented disarming yet. And so, through player innovation, players realized, like, oh, well, the 10-foot pole can be a really useful piece of equipment because you can use it to detect and set off traps from a distance. And I thought that was really cool. It's because they didn't have a save for it. They didn't have a skill check to disarm a trap.
They didn't even have a class for it.
That's right. And so, so it also says here, over the years, the 10-foot pole has been used in D&D to do the following. Find pits, bypass traps, climb ledges, prod corpses, poke large monsters to see if they're really dead. Pole vault over obstacles and chasms. Lever loose a statue. This is what I was hinting at before. Measure the depth of water or any other scary liquid. Strike a giant in the family jewels. Carry uncooperative quarry back to camp. And of course, pull a raft, canoe, or rowboat across a river. And there are many other uses for the 10-foot pole. And I thought it was... I mean, I've always loved this joke, but I loved reading about this. Despite its silliness, the 10-foot pole captured players' imaginations as a universal multi-tool to use in exploration. Entire Dragon magazine articles were dedicated to the merits of the 10-foot pole, and the trope even spread to other RPG systems. D&D adventuring parties would have a brave party member probe for traps using a 10-foot pole to locate the trigger, then safely disarm or expel it while the rest of the party was out of the room, presumably taking a whiz or having a smoke. Many DMs balked at PCs being able to safely avoid their snares. I've heard tales that some DMs would extend the blast radius of their traps past 10 feet, which just incentivized players to start carrying 11-foot poles.
You know, it's like funny because I was thinking that, like, there are certainly traps that have a larger radius and 10-foot pole won't really do the trick. Like, you know, a room that fills with gas, for example. But
you just carry a longer pole, of course.
Well, there's another key trap finder, trap triggerer, thing that I've heard of parties carrying around. Do you know what it is?
No, what is it?
Sack of chickens.
Oh, well, you know what's really funny, Tom? The very next thing I was about to say. Some DMs would declare that certain magical traps only trigger when they detect a life form, hence the necessity for players to use a 10-foot pole with a chicken on the end.
There you go. You gotta have your 10-foot pole sack of chickens.
Best of both worlds.
It's what we call the Tomb of Horror strategy.
So this article goes on to say, this isn't to say that the 10-foot pole didn't have a couple of glaring weaknesses. First, international players are befuddled by it because only 3 countries claim the imperial system for measurement. So for the other 192 countries, it would be a 3.048 meter pole, which just isn't as endearing. Second problem, where do you store an unwieldy thing? Don't even try and tell me that this 3-foot halfling is exploring an enclosed dungeon with a 10-foot pole strapped to his back. There are some options, the easiest be to simply pretend the 10-foot pole is kept in extra-dimensional plot space or a bag of holding. But alas, the 10-foot pole has ultimately fallen out of favor. It was too darn pragmatic to use the wizard's staff as a credible fill for the 10-foot pole, and on top of that, a skill check for disarming traps was invented. It became standard practice to have your rogue just roll to disarm or detect traps, and the 10-foot pole has slowly fallen out of usage. The current edition, D&D 5th edition, as of this recording, only passingly refers to the 10-foot pole among its equipment list, and young role players are the poorer for it.
It should also be said that, like, it mentions, like, you could hold a 10-foot pole in a bag of holding. If you have a bag of holding, what the hell do you need a 10-foot pole for? It's like...
Yeah, you can just carry all sorts of better things
exactly.
in there.
Exactly, and when you said, like, I could think of something you could do if a party member got petrified. So you mentioned, like, prying a statue loose, but it doesn't so much handle the problem of, like, depending on the size of the character, lugging their statue body around. But if you have a portable hole, now that's something I think will solve any number of these problems.
It's just a wide mouth bag of holding, man.
Yep.
Bag of holding solves way more of these problems
than the
10-foot pole
does. When you said starting item, I clarified non-magical because I would have said bag of holding bar none.
Oh, heck yeah. Absolutely. Easily the most useful item. It completely removes the need to keep track of your stuff, even. Which I guess is useful for a player, but, you know, for a DM, that's kind of annoying.
One time I was in a game. I was a player in a game, and we were playing Horde of the Dragon Queen, and there's a point in that campaign where there is a big, like, air battle, basically, with dragons and airships and stuff, and one of our party members prepared for that air battle by filling a bag of holding with cannonballs and then flew over top of an airship and emptied the bag of holding.
Should have just filled it full of chickens.
I mean, in other situations, I think that would be more appropriate. I don't know if the chickens would be so good for taking out an airship. So.
Well, we'll never know until someone tries.
Yeah, I guess so. So there's yours, the 10-foot pole. I have brought something that I've been using a fair bit because of, I think I mentioned it a bunch of times on the pod so far, is I have been running a cyberpunk game on the side, sort of a bi-weekly thing that is less, I probably put less organizational work into it than I do with my, like, you know, my main campaign, the one set in Drail. But it is a game where I and a bunch of friends are playing, like, we're playing 5th edition D&D, but everything is just cyberpunk. So I'm basically just reskinning D&D 5th edition for cyberpunk. And some of this I already had ready, like, you know, my firearms rules, which I talked about a bit previously. And I've mentioned, like, having special items for the MPOC as well that kind of fit in, like the ghillie suit and whatnot. But to help run this sort of cyberpunk-flavored D&D 5e game, we've also been using something that Wizards put out. You may be familiar with Unearthed Arcana, which currently, right now, Unearthed Arcana, what it is the regular sort of 5e test material releases. Basically, it's just like cool, interesting supplemental material for 5e player options that are released for free as a PDF that are not like official. Oftentimes they are like testing materials for a new class they are thinking of including in an upcoming product. But one of the releases for Unearthed Arcana was for 5th edition is Modern Magic. And I wanted to talk about this because it is very critical to my 5e game. And supplement generally includes things that are fairly useful. For example, ability checks and hacking tools. Most characters in a modern campaign setting are well-versed in using computers and are automatically successful when employing technology for mundane tasks, searching a hard drive or the internet, using the normal functions of an electronic device, and so on. For especially challenging technological tasks, finding hidden information on a computer, or storing information from a device that's been erased, and so on, a character makes an intelligence check against a DC set by the DM. However, some technical tasks, including breaking into protected computer systems, accessing hidden functions of electronic devices, or using a device in a way it was not designed for, require the use of specialized hacking tools. So, speaking of how important I think thieves' tools are as a basic item, we have included here hacking tools. This kit contains the hardware and software necessary to allow access into most computer systems and electronic devices. Proficiency with hacking tools lets you add your proficiency bonus to any intelligence checks you make to connect to or make use of a computer system or electronic device. The kit fits snugly in a backpack or toolbox. This supplement also comes with three new subclasses and a set of new spells. So just to quickly go over it, I'll just give the little introduction as well. When the 5th edition Dungeon Master's Guide was released in 2014, two pages in Chapter 9, Dungeon Master's Workshop, attracted a lot of attention. I can attest to this. Those pages covered the rules for using firearms and explosives, in an addition that allowed DMs to introduce modern and alien weaponry into the D&D world, as in the classic adventure, Expedition to the Barrier Peaks. And we've talked about that.
Yes. See previous episode.
But
several previous episodes.
What if we extended the D&D rules to cover a campaign not only touched by, but actually set in a modern era? The D20 modern role-playing game did that with the 3rd edition rule set in 2002. Now, the newest iteration of D&D features various archetypes, traditions, domains, and other options for the base classes, all of which present opportunities for customization. With that in mind, this article presents new rules for expanding the repertoire of spellcasting characters in a modern setting. These rules build on the behind the screens article, My New D20 Modern Campaign, which introduces sidearms, long arms, and modern armor for 5th edition D&D. I have not looked at that article, but there it is. You could probably find it. So it lists here city magic. Many of the class features and spells in this article depend on a character's presence in an urban environment to function. At the DM's discretion, these features and spells might function in smaller urban areas, such as sufficiently population-dense large towns or suburbs. However, they do not function in areas with little or no artificial construction, such as a wholly natural forest settlement, regardless of population. So we have a new domain for the cleric, which is the city domain. For many clerics in a modern campaign, life is dominated by the urban environment and its struggles. The city domain is concerned with the citizenry, commerce, traffic, and even architecture of modern civilization. In the eyes of a cleric of the city, the center of modern life is a sense of spirit of community, and the gravest enemies of the city are those who seek to harm the common weal of its citizens. And so you get things like bonus cantrip. You gain the on-off cantrip, which is a cantrip I'll describe here. This cantrip allows you to activate or deactivate any electronic device within 60 feet, as long as the device has a clearly defined on or off function that can be easily accessed from outside of the device. Any device that requires a software-based shutdown sequence can activate or deactivate. To activate or deactivate cannot be affected by on or off. And that is
that sounds like a Watchdogs cantrip to me.
Yeah, it's funny, in this cyberpunk game I'm running, which who knows, maybe I'll talk about it someday. But the character that this supplement is most critical for is the cleric who is playing a city cleric who is specifically dedicated to transit. He is basically a cleric of the old TTC in Neo Toronto. They gain proficiency with sidearms and proficiency with land vehicles at first level. They gain Heart of the City. From first level, you are able to tap into the spirit of community found in the city. While you are within any city, you gain advantage on a single charisma, deception, intimidation, or persuasion check, and you are considered proficient in the appropriate skill. You can use this feature a number of times equal to your wisdom modifier. You regain any expended uses when you finish a long rest. They also have Channel Divinity, Spirit of the City. As an action, you present your holy symbol. In this case, the guy's is an old Presto card. It's basically a bus pass. And any city utility within 30 feet of you either works perfectly or shuts down entirely for 1 minute, your choice. So he's used this to like shut down a critical blast door behind the party at one time. Additionally, each hostile creature within 30 feet of you must make a charisma saving throw. On a failed save, the creature is either knocked prone or restrained, your choice, by hazards such as entangling wires, high pressure water erupting from fire hydrants, pavement collapsing to unseen potholes, and so on. A restrained creature can escape by making a successful strength athletics or dexterity acrobatics check against your spell save DC. And there are more. Block Watch, Divine Strike, Express Transit. Express Transit, I'm sure he's really looking forward to, which is literally any transit stop, like a bus stop, train station, subway stop. You can teleport between those as if they were...
It's like a fast travel point. That's great.
Yeah. We also have, for the Warlock, a modern Warlock channels the unseen randomness of urban life, tapping into the energy of technology in unimagined ways, and gets the otherworldly patron Ghost in the Machine. You have made a bargain for power granted by an entity that you believe to be completely digital. Whether it is a rogue AI or the spirit of a deceased hacker, the Ghost in the Machine is capable of feats that defy explanation. So you get bonus proficiency in hacking tools. You get an ability called Information Surge that can temporarily render computerized devices inoperable. You get Wire Walk, the ability to travel short distances over electrical wires, data lines, or telephone cables by using a bonus action. You get Personal Encryption at high level. You get Technovirus, the ability to infect a humanoid's body with living circuitry. And there's a new invocation that is Arcane Gunslinger that allows you to make your pact weapon a gun. And then there is also the Wizard. Knowledge is the heart of the wizard's craft, and the modern environment offers knowledge undreamed of by most mages, allowing access to the arcane tradition Technomancy. Which comes with the proficiency in sidearms and hacking tools. Technological savant, you trade out your spellbook for a specifically attuned storage device of your choosing, capable of recording magical data. Spells copied into this device are at half the price of a normal spellbook, although I guess the way I do it, I just turn gold into credits, but whatever. And then they get program spell, they get online casting, they get chained device. You imprint vestiges of your consciousness on an electronic device with significant computing power. And then we've got new spells. I mentioned the cantrip on off, but we've also got in first level, we've got Infallible Relay, which basically lets you, it's like sending, but the person you're sending to needs to be near some sort of communication device. And that, so if they're near a phone, the phone inexplicably rings and then they pick it up and you come through like crystal clear no matter where you are. There's remote access, which is like on off, but lets you like actually start to, you know, interface with a device from a distance as if you like had a computer or a keyboard for it in your hands. Then there's arcane hacking, digital phantom, which is like you put like a digital version of yourself in the computer. There's find vehicle, which the transit cleric uses a lot, where he you know, conjures up a streetcar or a harbor hopper or whatever he needs to get the job done, basically. At third level, we have Haywire, which obviously sends machines haywire. Invisibility to cameras, so you become undetectable to electronic means of surveillance. And protection from ballistics, which gives you resistance to gunfire. At fourth level, there's Conjure Nobot. Actually, sorry, I was confusing Digital Phantom with Conjure Nobot. Digital Phantom just hides, it's like Pass Without Trace, but hacking. It hides your presence in a computer system. Conjure Nobot is the one where you create like sort of like a familiar within a computer that will act for you within a digital space. There's Synchronicity, which you can use. It's basically like it's kind of like Expeditious Retreat, but based around the city. So you can cast Synchronicity, and then suddenly you can sprint at full speed through a crowd because everyone just happens to get out of your way, like inherently. There's System Backdoor, which is you provide a way of sneaking into a system without people knowing about it. There's Commune with City, which you instantly gain knowledge of up to 3 facts of your choice about any of the following subjects as they relate to the area: terrain and bodies of water, prevalent buildings, plants, animals, or intelligent creatures, powerful, challenge rating 1 or higher, celestials, fey, fiends, elementals, or undead, influences from other planes of existence, and electrical currents, wireless signals, and active transit lines and tracks. And finally, there's the 5th level spell Shut Down, which you can use to fully shut down an electronic device. In fact, all electronic devices within range.
I was skeptical about this at the start, but this is actually super cool.
Yeah.
Like my party in the Verdant Apocalypse, they need one of these guys.
It's cool because I think they were really good about like making it not so extreme as to be inaccessible. Like, I think if these were more hardcore cyberpunk and had like, you know, they're designed so that they can be used in even just like a relatively modern campaign. It doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be a crazy hacking campaign. Some of these are useful even like, you know, today they would be useful, you know, Synchronicity, yeah, to just have green lights every time you need when you're in a hurry, or, you know, the like on off things like that. Like, they're not so complicated that it only really matters if you're playing a crazy like cyberpunk game, but they also work really well for that.
Super cool, man.
So yeah, that is what I brought to the tavern today, and I guess that's it for today's episode. So If you want to get in touch with me and McGill or the podcast in general, you can hit us up on Facebook, Compare and Campaign. We have a page on Facebook. You can get in touch with me personally on Twitter at Narnog, NAR_NOG. Nobody ever messages me on Twitter. It'll be pretty surprising if you do. And it's fine. I mean, I barely use it. I think that's pretty common for these podcasts is you list a Twitter handle, but like, you know, it's like if for some reason you use it. And then finally, most importantly, I'd say, you should check out our comparingcampaign.wordpress.com, which is our supplementary materials where we post links to things that we talk about in the tavern, like this Unearthed Arcana article. Maybe post a link to
or a video of a guy driving a motorcycle down the tunnels under Carlton.
Yeah, we need that. And probably check out Moving Out by Billy Joel on our supplementary materials. That'll also tell you who's not moving out of this podcast. Not me.
Level up your character.
And watch out, because role-playing too hard can give you a heart attack. Yeah, that's enough. The end, guys.